From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Mike Kennedy. This week, it's all about the world economy. In Greece, the financial crisis is taking its greatest toll on the young. In China, the government is trying to slow down the economy just as Western nations want it to speed up. Then it's back to Europe for an up-close view of the euro crisis. We begin this week's podcast on the streets of Athens. The financial crisis gripping Greece is having a major impact on the country's young people. A two-tiered labor market favors the older generation, and draconian austerity measures have triggered record-high joblessness among those under 35. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports the economic upheaval is undermining Greece's traditional family structure, and it's pushing young Greeks to leave the country in search of a better life.
It's Saturday night. The bars and cafes in trendy Monastiraki are packed. At the James Joyce pub at the foot of the Acropolis, a group of 20-somethings are holding a going-away party for a young doctor who has found a job abroad. His friends don't feel so lucky.
The general feeling is that the future doesn't depend on us.
31-year-old Johanna Zahariudaki gives private English lessons. She feels stuck here and just tries to survive.
I try to imagine myself 1 month from now. I don't know what the answer is. Because every month, every day, we hear different things. We don't know. We try to change them, but nothing changes. It doesn't feel like it's democracy anymore.
Youth unemployment in Greece is running at 40%, one of the highest rates in Europe, and rising as the economy rapidly shrinks. While the government is laying off middle-aged workers in the inflated civil service, this country of 11 million people last year lost 200,000 jobs in the private sector, where many young Greeks seek opportunities. It wasn't easy even before the crisis hit. The young used to be called the 700 generation for a monthly salary of 700 euros, less than $1,000. Now they're lucky if they make 500 euros, and they're rapidly disappearing from the labor market. The unemployment office is crowded. There are also women with babies waiting in line, and most everyone is young. 28-year-old George Koklas just got laid off as a driver and bodyguard at the finance ministry. Previously, he worked with his father as a house painter, a skill he believes is useful anywhere. Koklas has already put the word out on the international Greek grapevine. He hopes to go to the U.S. or Australia.
The only thing that has left for us is to quit the country and to immigrate to another country. I will feel very bad for my relatives, for my family, not for my country. My country now is a big disgrace.
Greece's large and growing pool of skilled as well as unskilled workers is attracting headhunters from abroad. The Australian embassy in Athens is already organizing work fairs in search of doctors and dentists, as well as plumbers and home care workers. Even Germany is putting out feelers for doctors and engineers. But in a country where family ties are intense, the number one topic anguishing the Greek household is, should the kids stay at home or seek their fortunes abroad? Despina Papadopoulou, who teaches social sciences at Athens University, says the economic crisis is having a radical impact on one of the traditional pillars of Greek society. Overprotective parents who coddle their children, promote their education, and yet keep them at home well into adulthood.
Now you have one or even both parents who have lost their jobs. This is undermining fundamental family relationships. They're exploding, not because of a change in people's outlook, but because social and economic conditions inside the family have changed.
The best educated generation in Greek history has had the rug pulled out from under their feet.
It's our future we're talking about.
28-year-old Lydia Manka is studying accounting and finance at Athens University. She comes from a middle-class family, but her father, an engineer, recently lost his job. She feels at a loss.
I have never thought before of leaving Greece and going out to find a job and But I think I have no future here.
We all of us studied hard. We got into a really good university in Athens.
And now they just it just means nothing.
But some young people still have a clear aim in sight. At this university dormitory, the students come mostly from low-income families, but scored high on their entrance exams and won good scholarships. Now that the government is slashing funds for education, the students are staging protests and occupying buildings. Evangelia Angelina is a 21-year-old medical student who wants to be a surgeon. Her father is a plumber and her mother is a cleaning woman. And she has no intention of leaving Greece.
I want to fight here with other people to change this situation and have a future in our country.
In the middle-class neighborhood of Elinoroson, 30-year-old Stella Kazdagli and her 35-year-old husband Alexandros Karamalikis are trying to make ends meet. The wife, managing editor of a magazine, has had her wages cut and has to pay a slew of new taxes. The husband lost his job as a record producer and is now a stay-at-home dad raising their 13-month-old daughter. He restores old pieces of furniture he tries to sell to friends. The couple says they'll stay in Greece.
But we will do that in a hostile environment, without good public school, without good public universities, without anything from the state. I mean, we give them money without taking something back. They just reduce their help to the society, not only to us, to the poor people that they really, really need it.
The economic crisis is not only upsetting the family structure, it's also putting the spotlight on a two-tier labor market where older full-time employees have up to now enjoyed job-for-life security, and a second-class group of workers, mostly poorly paid young people with short-term contracts and few or no benefits. George Kirtsos, a journalist and publisher, calls it a form of modern slavery. And he's not alone in thinking that the crisis could lead to some kind of uprising led by the young.
We'll have, let's say, a civil war among generations. Generations war in Greece. Because those that control the systems that are in the 50s or the 60s send a bill of their own failure to the younger generation.
Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Athens.
The American economy is struggling to grow. The European Union is trying to contain a debt crisis. And in a case of bad timing, the world's fastest growing major economy, China, is trying to slow down. If Western economies are hoping for a big boost to help them through these difficult days, NPR's Frank Langfitt reports they are unlikely to find it from China.
Shanghai has been one of the world's hottest real estate markets, but it's too hot for Chinese officials, who are fighting high inflation and what some fear is a housing bubble. Earlier this year, the Shanghai government tried to slow down real estate sales by restricting people from outside the city from buying more than one property. James Ye says the policy is working. He says deals for existing homes are really bad. Ye works for Shanghai Pujing Real Estate. He's sitting in an office filled with agents hunched over computers. Last year, I sold one property a month, he says. Now, I sell one property every 2 or 3 months. The real estate policy is part of a broader plan by the Chinese government to slow the country's staggering growth. Andy Rothman follows China's economy for CLSA, an independent brokerage and investment group. He says the Chinese government wants to slow down the economy and improve the quality of what it produces.
Here in Shanghai, over the last 10 years, the government has raised the minimum wage by 160%. And so this is a deliberate effort to get out of the business of focusing on assembling low value-added shoes and toys and to move more upmarket with better quality jobs that pay better.
Rothman expects China's economic growth to fall below 9% next year. That would be the slowest rate in a decade, but still fast by global standards.
Strong growth in China will put a floor underneath the global slowdown, but it's not going to save the world.
One reason? Most Chinese just don't have the purchasing power.
Chinese consumers are spending a lot. Retail sales growth here is 17%, but the Chinese consumer doesn't have enough money to make up for American consumers not going shopping.
Rothman's got a point. China's getting wealthier, but most Chinese still don't have that much money. Right now I'm standing on China's Wall Street in Shanghai, looking up at two of the world's tallest buildings. And next to me is a guy named Xiao Yandong, who makes his living selling pancakes each morning for about 50 cents each. Xiao scrapes his skillet clean and ladles on some batter. He cracks an egg and begins cooking. Xiao makes 200 Chinese breakfast pancakes a day, 7 days a week. He earns just $500 a month. Xiao doesn't have much disposable income. He hasn't taken his wife and 8-year-old daughter out to eat all year.
We buy groceries to cook at home because eating out is too expensive. Each meal costs between $40 and $50, and then it's gone. So we take the subway to a friend's house to eat dinner.
Whitney Wong, an English teacher, strolls by on her way to work. She earns more than three times what Xiao does, but she's saving most of it for an apartment. That leaves little to spend on Shanghai's pricey merchandise.
So many goods in some, you know, shopping mall, much higher than its original value. For example, the jewelry. Jewelry is one thing I haven't bought for a long time.
During the global slowdown in 2008, the government here spent billions of dollars on roads and bridges to prop up growth. This time, another dose of government stimulus spending seems less likely, unless demand for Chinese exports from Europe and the U.S. plummets. Again, Andy Rothman from CLSA.
If millions of migrant workers who are in factories, especially in southern China, assembling iPads and microwave ovens and DVD players lose their jobs, then you'll see a few quarters of a stimulus to find temporary jobs for those folks.
The American and Chinese economies remain highly interdependent, but China faces its own unique challenges, and its leaders are certain to focus on the risks to their economy before addressing the problems facing the U.S. and the European Union. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
Is the Eurozone crisis spreading? Many analysts say it is, and that this could even spell the end of the currency and the breakup of the European Union, with serious consequences for the entire global economy. NPR's Philip Reeves has just been to the heart of Europe and found things were a little shakier than you'd think. This is his report.
The people of Antwerp always know what time it is. Their soaring Gothic cathedral announces every hour with a flourish. The cathedral is testimony to this city's history as a major cultural and trading center. Antwerp's the second largest port in Europe and the world's largest diamond trading city. As the morning begins, people stride purposefully across the cobbles, heading off to work. We're in Belgium. The European Union and NATO have their headquarters in this country's capital, Brussels. For centuries, Europe's powers fought their battles on this turf. These days, though, the place is a picture of prosperity and orderliness. At least that's how it seems. There's something else you need to know. Belgium has no government. Perhaps that's putting it a little strongly. Belgium's regional and local governments are functioning just fine, but the federal government was elected 16 months ago and has been locked in coalition negotiations ever since. Talks are finally reaching a conclusion, long after breaking the world record for coalition haggling previously held by Iraq. Belgians don't seem particularly proud of this. 89-year-old Roger Slicks is waiting to catch a tram.
It's always financial. There is... people have no problem. Only the politicals, they have a problem. How many much money you can spend and I can spend, that's all.
The reasons forming a government's taken so long are complex. Underlying them, though, is a basic theme. Belgium roughly falls into two halves, straddled by Brussels. Antwerp is in the north, in the Flanders region. The people here, the Flemings, speak Dutch. In southern Belgium lies Wallonia. The Walloons speak French. Peter Luridan, economics correspondent for the Gazette van Antwerpen newspaper, says Wallonia used to be doing pretty well.
They have a great industrial history that collapsed in the 70s. And now they need the money from the Flemish part of the country, of the north. Yes, the north is in fact subsidizing them by the federal level. And the fact is that the north wanted some guarantees.
Let's get this straight. The wealthy, industrious Germanic North is piping money down to the poorer, less productive Latin South, and it resents that. Sound familiar? Gert Knowles from the asset management company Econopolis says Belgium is a microcosm of the tensions now surfacing in the Eurozone between the North, dominated by Germany, and struggling southern countries.
Belgium, in a certain way, is exactly Europe in small. With all the problems between Greece and Germany, on a smaller scale combined in this beautiful small country.
This small country is now feeling the effects of the Eurozone's larger problems. Europe's sovereign debt crisis is spreading to its banking system. A big Belgian and French bank, Dexia, is in trouble. Talks are underway right now to rescue it. Peter Lourdan believes things could get rough for Belgians if Greece actually defaults, as this would drive up government borrowing costs.
That could be critical for Belgium, I think. Greek default, that could be critical. I think first Spain, Portugal, Italy will be on a critical level, and then we are in the danger zone, I think.
As morning turns to afternoon, there's no sense of danger on Antwerp's streets. Students are celebrating the start of the new school year by downing large quantities of one of Belgium's biggest products, beer. As for having no federal government in Belgium, well, who really cares? Certainly not computer science student Thomas Flamant.
Some governments look at Belgium and the first thing they think about is that we have no government and all that. But I don't really believe all that. I mean, I just don't give a shit about it. It doesn't affect me one bit.
Philip Reeves, NPR News.
Coming up, Muammar Gaddafi still has plenty of support, even in places that have fallen to rebels. And in Iran, it's a dangerous place for a student who went home for the holidays. In Libya, anti-Gaddafi fighters are facing fierce resistance in Muammar Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. It's one of the last areas that has not fallen to rebel forces. But it's hardly the last bastion of support for the deposed leader, as NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro now reports from Tripoli.
It's a busy afternoon in the market in the southern Tripoli neighborhood of Abu Slim. People mill around the shops while stall owners hawk their wares. It doesn't take long for a man to approach a visiting reporter and say under his breath, "You know, we all support Gaddafi here." Soon after, a crowd gathers and one of the young men gains confidence. His name is Anis, but he says he speaks for most people in Abu Slim. "I am a Gaddafi loyalist. I want Muammar. Some people are afraid to speak out," he says, "but I'm not. All I've known is Gaddafi, and I felt secure back then. There are many of us who feel the same way," he says, "but we are afraid to speak out because we might get beaten or shot." Abu Slim was the last Tripoli neighborhood to fall to rebel forces. It's long been known as a hotbed of Gaddafi support. But it's not alone. By some estimates, as much as 30-40% of the population in Libya is sympathetic to Gaddafi. And how that's playing out in a place like Abu Slim provides a window into the potential problems Libya is facing in the aftermath of its brutal revolution. At Samoud Elementary School, children dressed in dark blue smocks with white scalloped collars line up before classes and sing the new national anthem. But getting the children here to learn the anthem hasn't been easy. Principal Fatia Ahmed says some children flat out refused to take the printout of the lyrics of the anthem when it was handed out. And she says only about half of the students who should be here are. Some parents are keeping their children home because they don't want them to learn the new revolutionary curriculum. Fatia Ahmed herself is new to the job. The previous principal was too closely allied to the former regime, she says, and is taking what she delicately terms an extended vacation. She says most of the people in Abu Slim are extremely poor, and they worked for the government or the army, which helps explain their sympathies. She says she spent the better part of the first 2 weeks of school trying to undo 42 years of indoctrination, speaking well of the rebels and the revolution to her students and their parents. But it will take more than that to change people's mind. Gaddafi gave little to this downtrodden neighborhood, but it's still more than they're getting now in these chaotic early days. At the local Abu Slim council, a woman comes to ask for help. She has three children, her husband's out of work, and her house was destroyed in the fighting. The Gaddafi government allocated her new lodgings, but the regime fell before she could move into the new house. Now she doesn't know who to turn to for help. Local council member Musba Shawish listens sympathetically, but then sends her away. We are all volunteers here, he tells her. We have no money and no power to grant housing. Shawish tells us that most of the people in Abu Slim can be brought over to support the new government if they see their lives improving. They are opportunistic, he says. We have tried to give them food and other goodies to show that we can provide for them. But it's a race against time. The longer there is no one to answer to the people's needs, he concedes, the better the former regime will look. And there will, of course, always be people who love Gaddafi, no matter what he says. What to do with them is something the new government hasn't quite figured out. At a checkpoint in Abu Slim, two anti-Gaddafi fighters argue about what they would do if they spot someone waving Gaddafi's green flag. One says, it's democracy. As long as they don't have a weapon, I would let them go on their way. The other waves his gun and says he would shoot them dead. Back at the market, Gaddafi supporter Anis says the new government should prove its democratic credentials. If this is real democracy, he says, don't shut us up. Allow us to say what we really believe. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Tripoli.
An Iranian who has been studying physics in Texas was put on trial in Tehran this week on charges related to espionage. He was arrested during a home visit in February, but his case became public just a few weeks after Iran released two young Americans accused of espionage and held for more than 2 years. NPR's Mike Schuster has more.
The student is Omid Kokabi. He is 29 years old, a graduate student at the University of Texas in Austin, studying optics. He went home to visit his family between semesters, and when he failed to return to Austin, his friends discovered he had been jailed and charged with communicating with a hostile government and taking illegal funds. When it became clear he would be put on trial, several organizations lodged protests. One of them, the American Physical Society, the largest group of physicists in the U.S., sent a letter to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Michelle Irwin is the Society's International Programs Administrator.
He was just here in the U.S. to do his studies, just like many other Iranian students and other foreign students. And so the charges of him having communication with a foreign, you know, with an enemy government or receiving illegal funds was just kind of ridiculous because this is something that many Iranian students are doing every day.
Irwin said the letter explained that Kokabi was studying optics, not anything in the nuclear field, which has been such a sensitive issue between the U.S. and Iran. She read from the letter's appeal.
We are also concerned that such treatment of scientific personnel will discourage other Iranian science students from seeking the pursuit of knowledge abroad. Such studies ultimately serve to enrich Iranian people and, of course, all of humanity.
Just last month, Iran released the two American hikers who had been in prison for more than 2 years, charged with espionage. That came during the visit to the UN of Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad had offered to swap them for Iranians held in American jails, but the U.S. showed no interest. Just why the authorities in Tehran arrested Kokabi is not yet clear, says Abbas Malani, who is the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University.
There have been very little official announcement where one can sense what it is that they are after in this kind of an affair. But after the release of the two, there's been a lot of bickering and attacks and counterattacks from the judiciary, from the conservative camp against Ahmadinejad, and from Ahmadinejad against them.
There was much criticism in the Iranian press aimed at Ahmadinejad and the judiciary, which oversaw the hikers' case and required each to pay $500,000 to be released, says Mohammed Sahimi, who writes for the website Tehran Bureau.
When the hikers were released, a lot of these mass media protested that why were they were released, first of all, because they were convicted of spying, and second, why there were no negotiations to release the Iranians that are jailed in the United States.
It is believed there are at least five Iranians serving prison terms in the United States on various charges of arms trafficking or other violations of economic sanctions. The criticism of the hiker affair has touched various political power centers in Tehran, especially the judiciary, says Abbas Malani.
Even from some conservatives against the judiciary, saying that the way you played this out made us look like gangsters. to require them to pay $500,000 for what was allegedly a serious national security crime is absurd.
Just how Omid Kokabi's case may intersect with these others is not clear, but it is in the hands of the judiciary, notes Mohammed Sahimi.
I interpret that as more of a domestic type of issue, you know, trying to extract something from the guy and then in the process make some accusations either against Ahmadinejad or the reformists or one of these human rights groups and so on.
As with all these cases, it's unclear what the next step in the process is. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Mike Kennedy.